Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 6 of 4 J's in a Comic. We have done enough now to make a trade paperback.
Yes.
Sweet. With me tonight, we have JP from Panamanga.com.
Hey, everybody.
And our resident battle axe, Joe Vicious.
Funk.
And oddly enough, we don't have our fourth J, but instead we've replaced him with Professor Sean O'Rourke for this evening's podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sean is a professor at Saddleback College, where he is a professor in the speech department. Tell us a little bit about what you do down there, Sean.
I teach their public speaking and argumentation classes, and I'm the debate coach for the Saddleback speech and debate team.
But before that, he was a comic clerk at the now defunct Comics and Comics, which from its ashes rose Waterfront Comics. Tonight, we're going to be discussing a book that Sean actually turned me on to about a dozen years ago called Midnight Nation. And before that, Sean has an interesting project, which he is going to tell us about. And go ahead and tell us about your project.
So once again, thank you for having me. The project that I'm here to also plug while I'm at your podcast is a new book coming out called Ages of Heroes, Eras of Men from Cambridge Scholars Press. And I'm very proud to say that I have an essay in it. It has about 15 essays from some wonderful scholars in the comic book field from various disciplines. And so for all you people who are fans of comic book and comic book history, I strongly encourage you to check it out. It'll be coming out in September. My essay is about comic book historiography and examines the trend of people who wrote history books about comics and spent their time defending the medium as worthwhile and something worthy of scholarly interest, and kind of shows how over the preceding decades from comic books' inceptions that people have become more interested in comic book history, and you see more work being done that spends less time justifying itself because comics have now more cultural acceptance and cultural currency. So please check your local comic book stores or Amazon.com and check out the book when it comes out in September.
Anything else you want to plug, Sean?
And of course, many of the writers who are in this book also work for the website popmatters.com, where I've also contributed some essays and reviews over the past 5 years. So if you're ever online looking for some good scholarship about comic books and comic book criticism, check out popmatters.com.
All right. And now back to us and our standard dick and fart jokes.
Now that all the scholarly input is done, we can get back to the good stuff.
All right. So first, a little housekeeping. Loyal listener Mary from Astoria, Queens, commented on what BQE is from our Superior Foes and Hawkeye Bro podcast. BQE actually stands for the Brooklyn Queens Expressway. Now, if you're like me and only know about New York from playing Grand Theft Auto, I wouldn't have found that out. So thank you, Mary, for letting us know about that. And now on to our show. Tonight, we're going to be discussing Midnight Nation, written by J. Michael Straczynski. Straczynski has been a writer for a long, long time. He got started in the early 80s on TV. He's probably most well known before comics for creating Babylon 5 and writing most of the episodes of that.
I believe 92 out of the 100 and something episodes.
Yep. So you can just watch his and the one Neil Gaiman episode and probably be pretty good with.
Yeah, I think so.
And after he finished that, he actually went to do what he loved and he started doing comics. Midnight Nation was the second comic that came out from his Joe's Comics imprint. The first being Rising Stars, which was also very good, even though it took forever to come out. But Midnight Nation actually came out on a fairly decent schedule. The artist on it was Gary Frank, and they later went on to Marvel to do the Squadron Supreme relaunch. And then Gary Frank has now been working at DC doing Superman and other great stuff like that. So on to Midnight Nation. Sean, you want to get us started with this? You were the one that first recommended this to me years and years ago.
Well, one of the things I loved about Midnight Nation, and John and I were talking about this earlier, how you reread a book as you get older and you start to notice things that you didn't before, was just how original it was and how fun it was. Everybody loves Rising Stars from the Joe's Comic imprint, but I always thought Midnight Nation deserved more attention than it received. And for me, rereading it after all these years and looking back at it, you really see how it's not just a standard story, but it really qualifies, I think, as a literary epic. And it reminds me of that old adage about how every story is either an Iliad or an Odyssey. How every story is either about conflict or it's about a journey. And when you read this book and it takes this long journey of a cop trying to get his soul back and heading back to Manhattan, you really see traces of Dante's Inferno, a person walking to a confrontation with essentially the devil guided with the help of a supernatural being and all the things they confront along the way. And I always thought it was just such a wonderful and original story. But it also really, I think, showed some of the incredible abilities that comics have to tell unique stories, but at the same time, following the tropes that have so much scholarly and literary merit. I mean, you see some people and tell them this has shades of Dante. They may not believe a comic can do that. But that's one of the things that made Midnight Nation so fascinating.
Okay. Well, how the story breaks down is we're introduced to an LAPD detective, David Gray. And anytime I hear the name, the song Babylon goes through my head. I'm probably one of the few people that are getting that reference right now. And
yeah, right over my head.
Now, when you explained it, then I remembered.
So anyway, David Gray is an LAPD detective who is investigating a homicide where someone has been cut up and put into...
Well, it's actually the second homicide, right? Because the first homicide was out in the street of a drug dealer.
That's correct.
And then he gets pulled aside by the only person who's willing to talk to him. And this guy is scared out of his wits. He's hiding in this alleyway. He gets over. He's jittery and nervous. And at first you're thinking, like, well, maybe this guy's some kind of a tweaker or something. But then you realize that he's terrified to his bones about them or the men. Not the man. I love that reference. When they're first talking, he's like...
It's about cops?
He's, you know, the man. It's like, what do you mean, cops? It's like, no, not the man. The men. But yeah, so he's really terrified. And the next thing you... And so then his higher-ups at the
police station
are wanting him to move on to something else. And so he's thinking like, oh, I really think that I should follow through with this, but these guys give me a hard time. And then the next thing you know, he's at another murder. And sure enough, it's the gentleman that talked to him in the alleyway. And
he's cut up into a refrigerator.
He's cut up in so many different pieces. Yeah. And his head happens to be in the refrigerator.
Yeah, I loved how they explained why all of his different parts were everywhere.
Yeah.
His foot was in the toilet for footstool. His head was in the refrigerator for a head cold.
Yeah.
His hand was on a chair for armrest.
Armchair.
Yeah. Armchair, right.
And so we discovered this, and Detective Gray keeps continuing to now investigate these murders, because they don't want it to blow up to a full-on serial killer situation. And
what did they say, that like two is coincidence and three is a hobby?
Yeah. And that leads us to Lieutenant Gray tracking down the killer. And you see these goblin-like creatures come out and attack him, and Lieutenant Gray is shot and wakes up in a hospital bed, and no one can hear him in the hospital
or see him.
Basically, he has drifted into a world which is between the two worlds, between heaven and hell, reality and the afterlife.
All the people who have fallen through the cracks of society.
Yeah, basically anything that's been discarded or ignored long enough. Be it a person or an item or something like that. I love how they can only interact with other things or people that have also been discarded or fallen through the cracks, quotes. And that if they want to make a phone call, they have to go to a phone booth that is no longer in operation and is just busted up and left.
Which now, a dozen years later after this has come out, can you find any phone booths anywhere?
I don't think I've seen a phone booth in years. I really haven't.
I think I saw one a while ago, maybe a year or two ago. But it didn't look like it worked. It looked like it was somebody's house.
So in other words, now the TARDIS is really out of place.
Very, very much out of place.
Time machine from Bill and Ted's.
When Detective Gray wakes up, there is a young lady there in the room that's kind of explaining things with him and takes him to get the answers to where he's at.
Yeah, and you basically find out that his soul has been taken from him and that she is his guide who is going to take him to New York City. So they have to cross all the way to the East Coast from the West Coast on a journey to get his soul back. And if he doesn't, he will become
a walker.
A walker, like one of the goblin creatures John talks about. So they have to go on this long walk to get his soul back and hopefully reclaim it. And one of the things that she warns him is, so far, no one has ever made it through the journey. They have all, when they got there, decided to become walkers. So he says he's going to be the one that breaks that cycle.
What's really cool is when they encounter people that have fallen through the cracks, everyone knows Laurel, the guide, and respects her. And then they see him and they know what's going to happen to him. So they're just kind of giving him the cold shoulder, knowing that in a year, he's probably going to, more than likely, will become a walker.
Well, I can remember a little ways in when they're walking down this lonely road in the middle of nowhere and they pull off to the side. Well, not pull off because they're not in a car, but they walk off the side. to try and get some food and some rest, and they come to a campfire bunch of other people that are falling through the cracks or in between.
That issue was my favorite comic story ever for a long time.
Really? Wonderful issue.
Definitely. Yeah, that was very powerful.
Basically, they come across these people, and they're telling their story about how they fell through the cracks. Mm-hmm. And everyone's telling their story. And then finally, after, you know, a dozen people have told their stories, David says, "I've had enough.
Clearly disturbed. Yeah. Storms right off.
Mm-hmm. So he gets out and he walks and he gets to the ridge and he looks down and sees there's literally hundreds of these campfires.
Just ongoing fields of fires and all in these little ditches with the ridges mm-hmm. around them. And everybody at every fire is afraid of going over the ridge because you never know. The road, people leave and they never come back and the road kills you and it's dangerous out there. And it's better to be safe than sorry. I'm just going to stay at the fire.
Better the devil you know than the one you don't.
Yeah. Right, right.
When I was talking to Sean earlier today, I was talking about how a book means something to you at different stages of your life.
Yeah.
When I first read this book, I was coming out of a failed relationship. I was taking care of my grandmother at the time, and she had passed away. You know, most of my friends had grown up and moved on and had their own life. So I was living kind of like a very lonely existence where I felt I could have become one of those people that slipped through the cracks. Now, 11 years later, married, have a daughter, a store, and all that, where I'm like in a completely different place. But that's why this was so resounding to me the first time I read it. Mm-hmm. You know, but now moving on, it's like, okay, that was one point in my life. Now I'm over here, and I don't think I could be that person.
No, I think that the story, I noticed, goes through, like, has to make this poor character, like, dredge himself through the worst emotions in humanity. He goes through having to face his most resounding fears,
his own weaknesses.
Yeah, he has failings. To face despair. He has to face his own rage, his own pride, his own guilt, and overcome each of these things to eventually get to the end.
I really like the issue where they're going through Chicago where his now ex-wife has resided and wanting to see her.
And apologize.
And apologize, yeah. But by doing that, it makes her susceptible to the walkers. But he was able to save her at the end and give her kind of that bit of hope to go on.
Mm-hmm. And that's definitely where you kind of see those allusions to Dante in the book, where he's walking with his guide and they see different people who are damned in the various circles of hell. And it follows that kind of same structure in the book, where as they go, they see not only different people who are damned on some respects, but he also sees his own, as you say, weaknesses and failings reflected in their mistakes. And like John was saying, just how close that could have been him. And I think definitely that had to have been in Straczynski's mind, the Inferno, when he was creating that, because you see so much of that in that storyline.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities between the two. I can remember feeling like it was interesting and powerful when David was talking to Laurel, and she was reminiscing about a man who had been with her before on this journey. And she was saying, oh, he learned what he needed to learn along the road and very quickly and was doing great. And he said, well, what do you mean? What he needed to learn? Why don't you just tell me? And she said, I can't. It's different for everybody. And so, you know, each person that goes on this journey, there's something unique that they need to go through. And so each of these experiences, it's interesting because even though she's clearly been doing this for a freaking long time, that it's still
unique.
It's unique. Yeah. There's an unknown element each time because each person is different and unique in their own way and needing to see and experience and go through facing their own inadequacies and problems that are unique to them every time. It was really cool. I like the way that they did that, where they went through these different experiences and met these other people who have been forgotten and fallen through the cracks. And somehow they always seem to run into somebody who had a story that resonated with David somehow.
That one was that the Are We There Yet guy she went
yeah,
with?
Yeah, that was the Are We There Yet guy. That was so powerful.
Great sequence. One of the walkers that she escorted on his journey, who ended up staying and becoming a walker, later on changes his mind and wants to get help to his family. And there's a beautiful scene, which I think really illustrates Gary Frank as an artist, when he gives the number to the secret account he had so his wife and kids can be okay money-wise. And the wife
is saying thank you, and the walker hears it, and you see the guy just collapse into the phone booth. And I think that was one of those beautiful moments. It really shows the strength of Frank as an artist.
Well, and what's so cool is that these walkers are vile looking. I mean, mm-hmm. they're wicked. They're this awful putrid green color with these terrible sort of tribal sharp looking tattoos all over them. These big yellowed eyes with these tiny little beady pupils and
and these teeth, pointy nose.
Yeah, this awful like Joker smile kind of thing.
The most like inhuman face.
And he was able to take that creature, because it's really a creature. It doesn't seem like a man. That creature, and make it have recognizable human emotions to the point where you would resonate with this guy.
They always reminded me, too, I wasn't a big Buffy fan, but the Smilers from that, the musical episode, was it?
Yeah.
They always reminded me of that, that same kind of look, just add the tribal tattoos.
So moving on, how the book is structured, the first 9 issues are basically the journey, and issues 10 and 11 get us to having David meet up with, some people will say it's the devil, and I think that's pretty much what Straczynski was going for.
Mm-hmm.
And
they never said it right, but there's a lot of similarities and imagery that's very much Christian.
Yeah. Comes out and says, I rebelled against the creator.
As someone who doesn't swing very religiously, it was an interesting take, I thought. You know, Sean, what did you think about the soliloquy that the devil gives at the end? I know that you've done a lot of research and written a lot about that.
Yeah, when I was doing what we call a reader's theater for the OCC speech and debate team, where you get a lot of different literature and put it together under one unifying theme. I did one on supervillains, and I use this little monologue that the devil has towards the end of Midnight Nation in it as kind of the central theme of it. Because I really think that when you're getting there, you keep saying none of the walkers got their souls back. None of them went with Laurel. They all ended up staying. So obviously, there has to be a fairly compelling reason that no one succeeded in the quest, that it ended in failure every single time for Laurel. And I think the buildup is absolutely worth it. When you get to meet the devil and you hear his speech, I found it absolutely compelling. And it was one of, I think, one of the best kind of iterations for why a devil-type figure would gain so many adherents. And basically, the argument he puts forth is that if you're the creator, why add misery into the world?
That was the question. That was, why make misery? And since you have misery, he created hope just to make sure that nobody paid attention to how miserable they were.
They all think that the next day will get better, but according to the devil, it won't. Things get progressively worse. And hope is the lie that underscores the flaw in creation, which to him is misery. His basic argument is, at the beginning of time, nothing existed naturally, so why did the creator add misery to the human experience? And so the devil and the group of walkers are trying to increase the quotient of misery, not because they're inherently evil, as you are led to believe through the first parts of the story, but because, according to him, if the misery reaches a certain point of critical mass, then they win and they will be able to create a world without misery. So you find out all the evil they're doing throughout the book, killing people, dealing drugs, is all in service of revealing the flaw in creation that will allow them to take over and recreate a world. And I think it's a very compelling vision that is worth the wait to get there.
You know, what's funny is when I was first reading that, I thought to myself, that sounds so much like a classic supervillain thing, where I'm not evil, the world's evil, and I'm going to destroy the world so we can start over.
Actually, that's funny. That just reminded me of a series that Marvel put out recently, maybe a couple years ago, the Doom War. Dr. Doom is taking over and like leads an attack on Wakanda to steal all the vibranium.
That was Doom War. Yeah.
It was Doom War? Okay. Because he has to pass through like a spiritual check to get into the vibranium vault. And so the spirit of the Black Panther asks him, why do you deserve this entry that obviously you're going to use for nefarious purposes? You know, I have to check your heart to make sure that you are a pure intent. And Doom strips off his armor, says, check. And Panther looks at him and says, okay, yeah, you're good. Because he says, I have traveled to every possible future. And the only one I've seen without apocalyptic visions is the one where I rule the world. And so, yeah, all right, you got pure intentions. Go ahead. Go ahead, take over the world. You deserve it.
And that's why we all love Dr. Doom.
That's pretty great.
And he's still a bastard, even though.
Yeah, you definitely do see those kind of, those, like you're talking about, John, the staples of the supervillain in there. And it's also interesting how it kind of falls into that classical dichotomy of good versus evil, where on the one hand you have the devil, in this case, trying to upset the status quo, whereas Laurel represents keeping things the exact same and maintaining the system. So then you kind of, it just really becomes a question of perspective over who's right, a world that's messed up but still has hope, or a blank slate and a restart.
It really feels like there's just a bunch of gray area. That when you really get to the end of this and you get that amazing monologue from the devil and you really see everything laid out in front of you, it's kind of like, well, man, who's the bad guy here? Like, what's really going on? I mean, obviously, we can just say, well, the devil's a bad guy because he's drawn in a sort of nefarious, dark, creepy way and all the walkers look like bad guys. But at the end of the day, if you really look at this just on paper, without the imagery to support the creepy, you know, sort of look to these guys, it's like, it really doesn't feel like there's a clear answer.
Mm-hmm. And even though you see the walkers enjoying the murder and the mayhem throughout the book, during the devil's little monologue, you actually see them weeping. Like, as they're helping him kind of act out some sequences, you see they're all crying towards the end because, on one level, despite the fact that they're monstrous, they still believe in his critique against the world.
Well, and I think that it was interesting that the reason why they enjoy all the mayhem and murder and death and trouble that they're creating, and the reason why they have that, what he called freedom, is that they've given up the illusion of hope. And once they've given up the illusion of hope, then there's no longer misery. It's like hope and misery are hopelessly intertwined in this story, in the devil's perception, which obviously the walkers share with him. Otherwise, they wouldn't have chose to work with him or wouldn't have chose to be his servants. But the idea that hope and misery are wrapped up in each other, and it's almost like you can't have one without the other, is kind of what it feels like. Because, I mean, if you think about it, and it's what, I don't know, at least it's what I was thinking when I was reading this, is that if where you are isn't worse than where you'd like to be, you know, if there isn't misery in your life, then you're not going to hope for something, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's just this weird sort of chicken or the egg kind of thing going on. And yeah, like I just thought it was a really interesting perspective.
Yeah, like when the devil says his main goal is to create a new world without misery, with only pleasure. Well, how are you going to be able to tell?
Which would be void of hope also.
Yeah. How are you going to be able to tell you're experiencing pleasure? You don't have anything to compare it with.
And even though we never get the full criticism of the devil's vision, at the end of the day, that does seem to be the trade-off. That it's pure freedom that he offers, but at the same time, it's an immoral freedom because it doesn't have that hope. And it also seems that the misery that the status quo represents is one based on at least human agency and choice. And it seems like even though they don't get into it too much, the world the devil wants to recreate seems to be one that fundamentally would deny that human choice and thus to prevent misery. Deny agency. And they don't really go too far in it, but you kind of see how they could keep the criticism of then the devil's world and the fundamental flaws in his vision going if they wanted to. And I think that's part of the reason why you see the walkers do such terrible things, but also enjoy doing it and relish it, to show that even the devil's alternative world may not be flawless.
I really liked at the end that Detective Gray ends up being the one that rejects the devil. And by doing that, he gives Laurel a chance to end her endless cycle and thus providing hope to everyone that had fallen between the cracks. We saw this great panel where he rejects her and gives his soul. Detective Gray gives his soul to Laurel and a beacon shoots in the sky. And everyone that's fallen between the cracks looks up and you start to see people re-enter into the real world.
Because all of a sudden they have hope.
Yeah. And, I mean, that was a really powerful scene to me.
Oh, absolutely. I think one thing that stood out to me in this comic was that as you're going through this story, as you're meeting these, well, non-humans, so I guess these creatures that are seemingly stuck in this perpetual cycle, that the wild card, the element that has the ability to create change and the catalyst to break this cycle of trial and failure, misery, is humans. And that that is the unique piece there. And that all these supernatural creatures, even the devil, who in his own way is trying to follow his own path and not just be a servant and try and make a change himself, that he himself still is stuck in this perpetual cycle Whereas bringing in a human into that mix, eventually that human spirit, that human hope, that ability to, look at something and still choose to feel how we feel about it instead of get wrapped up in the misery of what seemingly are the facts. Yeah. And still have hope, even when there's no real reason to have hope. It was just really interesting. It was a very kind of like human spirit is such a powerful thing. And it's definitely part of what this resonates with me about.
Yeah, that was something I've always read in Straczynski books is his real insistence that the human spirit is what makes heroes real heroes and what makes us stronger than all the outside forces in all the galaxy. And it's always a very uplifting sort of thing to read.
Definitely. I'm glad that it wasn't the fifth element that saved everybody, though, because that was... I'm glad about that, because any of you that know or have listened to our previous podcast know I hate that. When the answer is love, it's like, next.
Oh, I'm passing on the battle axe. Hawaii.
We'll revisit this in 10 years and see what...
Forever alone.
Do you mind if I read one part real quick?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely, we might.
Uh-oh. I'm going to do it anyway, John. This is probably, I think, my favorite part of the entire book, and I think it really encapsulates the devil character's critique, and it's about midway through their journey, he gets one opportunity to talk to David before then David gets to New York City, just to kind of preview. And he has this great paragraph that I've always loved, and I think it really captures Straczynski's strength as a writer and his ability to create dialogue. And he writes, "Filthy streets, drive-by shootings, irradiated corn, permissible amounts of rat droppings per hot dog, bomb blasts and body counts, terror in the streets on your camera in your living room, AIDS and Ebola and hepatitis B, and you can't touch anyone because you're afraid you'll catch something besides love, and nothing tastes as good anymore, and Christopher Reeve is in a wheelchair, and love is statistically false." And then the great line, "You grow up frustrated, you live confused, you age frightened, and you die alone." And I think that right there, just holistically, especially for some reason with the line about Christopher Reeve in the wheelchair, just captures the misery and the problems with the world that he's in his own way fighting against. And I just thought that was such a beautifully poetic paragraph. And that whole page, because the discussion goes on, really shows just how compelling the devil's argument against the world is and what a strong character Straczynski's created.
It's perpetually refreshing when you come across a nemesis, an enemy, a bad guy, or a villain that is not twirling his mustache, meh, snidely whiplash, just evil for evil's sake, but really genuinely feels like he's doing the right thing. That absolutely adds to the power and the believability is that if you can, in your own, if a writer can somehow make it feel like, oh, I can kind of see where he's coming from. That the bad guy isn't being bad just to be bad, but the bad guy, the villain, is really truly acting out of what he feels is the best interests of all.
And as John pointed out, it's not his rejection of the bad guy that breaks the cycle. It's his love for Laurel. At the end, David really seems to reject the dichotomy of good versus bad, and it's his love of her specifically that allows him to break free. And so it's funny because it's almost like he chooses not to play and just goes to save her, and that becomes the terminal thing that stops it, not his desire to join the heroes and be on the good side. It's just his love for that character.
And my favorite part of that is after David gives his soul to Laurel, and the devil's sitting there perplexed going, I didn't see that coming.
Right.
Yeah, he didn't even seem particularly disappointed about it. Yeah. You know, it wasn't like he was angry, like, no,
no,
foiled again.
Yeah, the whole time he's saying, are you sure you want to go through with this? And he's talking to Laurel. It's like, you can just say no. You can rebel. You don't even have to join me. You can just say that you don't want any part of it anymore.
Yeah, you don't have to play this game anymore.
You don't have to suffer through this.
I like how he clearly has history with Laurel and really cares about her, says that he once loved her and doesn't want to see her suffer, but it's almost as if he's sort of begrudgingly going through the motions, and as is she.
And I think he even says that that's the creator's punishment, sending her
to see him over and over again. Yeah.
So what did everyone think on a rating scale?
Well, out of 5.
Well, if I had to pick between the side of the devil and the side of the angels, since the angels are walking around in thongs and bare midriffs, I go with angels. And I'll definitely give this a 5. This was one of those must-read sort of comics.
For me, I'd definitely give this a 5 as well. I love that it's self-contained, that it doesn't invite a bunch of unnecessary spin-offs, that it's a perfect self-contained story that I think simultaneously highlights the strengths of the medium and really hits on some really strong stuff. As I said before, I think this one would definitely follow under the tropes of a literary epic. It hits the big ideas and invites the reader to reflect on them in a way that I think all great writing, be it comic books or literature or anything, should and does.
Well, I love the story and I love the artwork. I had a little bit problems with the production of it. For some reason, they chose to pull the chapter breaks out and make it one giant long story. If they had left the covers in there and broke it up into the 12 parts that it needed to go, that it went. I mean, real books have chapter breaks in them. This could have as well. Because I was wondering, where does this all fit in? Was this in the middle of an issue? Is it the end of an issue? But the story and the artwork itself were phenomenal. I had a little bit of a problem with the production of how the book was laid out. But other than that, I give the story, you know, definitely 4.5 to 5 on the scale.
So I'm a little torn on this. As I was reading it, I'll be completely honest, the first maybe third of it, I was not liking it. I mean, I was interested and entertained, but it just wasn't resonating with me, I guess.
It was a good enough adventure story until it got to the meat of it.
Yeah, exactly. And then I had this sort of crisis about, like, how do I really feel about this at the end when the devil comes out and starts to do his, what at this point feels kind of like a kind of tired old, same old motivations and villain sort of speech. And then after thinking about it more, I thought to myself, what do you mean tired, same old, same old? It's like in this is very much the original villain, right? This is, and not only that, but it's not the perspective of some sad, screwed up human being who has a very small view and understanding of things. In this, if you take for granted the idea that there is a maker, there is a creator, and he did create everything from nothingness, and nothing exists without his decision to make it exist, then that adds a whole other level to things, because it's not just a human being's interpretation of the way the world works, it is a real and true candid observation of how it actually works. And you can't help but almost agree with the devil as he's going. It's like, I kind of understand where you're coming from. Like, I get your thought process. And it just felt like it was deeper than I originally thought it was. You know, when he started coming off and it's like, I'm going to destroy the world to make it better, I thought, okay, here we go again. But as he continued on with this amazing monologue about how he feels and why it is like that, and why is it like that? It doesn't have to be that way. Nothing exists without the creator's will to make it exist. Like, why is it this way? It's wrong. It doesn't make any sense. It shouldn't be this way. Let's tear it down. It added a whole other level to it. It added a whole much more richness and texture, I think, than your basic, oh, you know, humanity has lost its way and I'm going to blow it all up and we're going to have a post-apocalyptic society with me on a giant, you know, concrete throne. Blah! You know, so I think I'm going to give it a 5. I really didn't think I was going to give it a 5. I thought I was going to give it more like a 4 for most of the book. But after our conversation and after really getting all the way through the end, it really came through and changed my opinion of it.
And what an excellent point, too. I never even considered that before, but you make it just so many villains, their biggest flaw in some respects is just a failure of perspective.
Yes.
But if there is any villain that could lay claim to a justifiable argument against the world, it would have to be the devil.
Yes.
The one person who was there from
the beginning.
Basically,
right,
the beginning, precisely.
And that's being said with 2 atheists in the room.
That's why Midnight Nation turned me that way.
I think it's what turned Straczynski that way, too.
Sean and I created our own religion after reading Midnight Nation.
Oh.
Okay. We're going to have to tell him, John.
Yeah, we got
No, I'm just going to leave it there.
That'd take an entire podcast.
Yes.
We'll just say this. It was fun religion that we created while bored on Sundays at the comic book store that somehow spawned a Wikipedia entry that we did not create.
Oh, okay. That's impressive.
And so it somehow had some sort of life beyond the comic book store until one day we found it on Wikipedia, the faith we created as a joke, got a entry.
Nice. That's awesome.
Well, thanks again, everybody, for listening to this. This one was fun. mm-hmm. and very, very deep. Next week, we'll be just doing a book that is just fun and not so deep. We're going to be reviewing Brian K. Vaughan's Saga.
The first two volumes.
Yeah, the first two volumes are
out. Wonderful book.
Issue 13 will be shipping later this month. So we'll give you kind of get you caught up on where we're going with that. It'll be interesting because this is the first time we've done something that hasn't been finished yet.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be like a work in progress. So
well, we talked about Wolverine Max, which isn't quite finished yet.
Yeah, you're right.
And Hawkeye and Superior Foes.
Well, I take that back.
Incorrect.
Thunk.
God damn it.
Took my axe back.
The battle axe.
It is either finished or it's not. All right, guys. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you next week, where unfortunately we won't have Sean, but we will be having Justin Woods back with us.
So the podcast will be a lot longer again.
We love you, Justin.
No, we really do.
Good night.
Oh, well, actually, I wanted to add one more thing. We are on iTunes now, so you can go ahead and subscribe us to iTunes. Yeah, it's kind of a funny story, too, because I didn't submit it, and John didn't submit it. And I don't really know, like, how that happened, but now we're there.
So. The same benefactor that put our religion on Wikipedia.
I'm thinking that it's weird, though, because our image isn't up yet. And I know that sometimes iTunes takes some time to filter all the information in and get us into the search queries and stuff and catalog all of our stuff into their database. And so perhaps that's what's going on, but I don't know, it's weird. Like, I don't
really
know.
What are we under?
We're under, I think, Arts Literary.
No. What is the actual name of our podcast? Is it 4J's and a comic?
No, it's not. It's Waterfront Comics. So I'm going to try. Like, that's the problem is that we didn't submit it, so we didn't get to make all those choices. So if one of you guys out there submitted it, fess up. What happened? Because we didn't do that, and we didn't do that because we weren't ready yet. We were still planning about how we were going to put it on there, and I was going to sit down with John, and we were going to put it out exactly as we like.
I mean, unless I press some weird button on weird press.
It's possible, but I looked around and didn't see anything that was some kind of random automated thing. But anyway.
Well, that's exciting news.
Yes, so we're on. You can find us on iTunes, so you can subscribe there. And very soon I will go through my insanely giant laundry list of places to download the podcast from. So, all right.
Thanks for everyone for listening. Good night.